For over 70 years, British comedy has woven itself into the fabric of our national consciousness, creating stars and helping to shape the universal television viewing experience. Comedy can be as diverse and wide-ranging as life itself, and British comedy's rich landscape epitomizes this. So please don't adjust your set. We'll take it from here if you're not being served, as we explore the wide-ranging and often bizarre world of British comedy with some of its best-loved stars exclusively on Beyond the Title.
Legendary comedian and entertainer Tommy Cannon earned his status as a bona fide national treasure as one half of the much-loved double act Cannon and Bull, alongside the late, great Bobby Bull. Meeting in the 1960s at a factory where they worked as welders, Tommy joined Bobby as a singer in the pubs and clubs around Oldham, and the pair developed their comedy act between songs. Taking advantage of the growing phenomenon of working men's clubs, Tommy and Bobby promptly joined the circuit and soon became regulars on ITV's The Wheel Tappers and Shunters Club, presented by comedian Bernard Manning. But in 1979, Cannon and Bull secured their own self-titled Saturday night variety show on ITV, which ran for 9 years until external forces led to the breakdown of their relationship. Yet finding religion would encourage them to reunite for the last 20 years of Bobby's life, and a cameo on ITV's I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here would help reinstate them as light entertainment kings. I caught up with the comedy legend to talk double acts, loss, and how he intends to rock on. Ladies and gentlemen, Tommy Cannon.
So I'm fascinated, I'm obviously being Josh, fascinated by the art of double acts in the way they almost become one entity. Unlike people like Corbett and Barker or Badil and Skinner, who were separate performers who come together, you and Bobby, like Eric and Ernie, you had a symbolic relationship which almost made you one and the same. With this in mind, how difficult is it to separate your individual talents? What's the process you've gone through to realise your own individuality since his passing in 2020?
It's a good question. To be honest with you, when Bob passed away, I think one of the saddest things was that I couldn't go and visit him because of COVID. We attended the funeral and shouldn't have done, but there was no way I were missing it. And I went to St. Anne's, and then the strangest thing of all was that I hadn't cried up to the going to the church. It was the strangest thing, and I'd had interviews and things, and for some strange reason, I suppose deep down I thought that he was going to come back, and it was only when I was in the church that when the coffin were coming down the middle aisle, I turned and looked at the coffin coming, and I thought, oh, my God, that's him. He's never coming back. And I broke down in the church, sobbing my heart out and what have you. And I think that was a bit of a release for me, sort of thing, you know. So, yeah, it has been strange. I'm trying to keep the legacy going of me and Bob. I don't want it to disappear. We had a fabulous career, and I want to do things in honour of Bob.
Yeah. You and Bobby were in a club in Manchester on the 26th of October 1963, sharing the bill with unknown comedian Jimmy Tarbuck. The following night, he made his debut on the heavyweight Sunday night at the London Palladium and become an overnight star. How do you think Jimmy's fame helped the Northern club circuit at that time?
Oh, it was a shock to me and Bob. I think it was the Manchester City club, I think, that we did. And I know Jimmy was on. And the following night, he was on at London Palladium. And I went, wow. But you don't realise how long you've been going before he got to that status. And you do, you know, it was the same with me and Bob. The press said overnight successes, Cannonball, television and all that business, but we'd been 15 years going around working men's clubs and pubs and being paid off and thinking to ourselves, oh my God, we can't carry on like this. We've got families, we've got to, you know, bring money into the house and stuff. And, you know, we carried on and I suppose the rest is all news, but we had a fabulous career, but we were very doubtful for a long, long time that we were doing the wrong thing.
And did you ever go to Butlins?
Justin, did you ever go to Butlins?
Yes, we did, actually. We did... Butlins were very hard work in those days. We did two or three Butlins and we enjoyed them, but the problem was that when you was in the room where the entertainment went on, so did a lot of other things while you were on stage. Like one of the Butlins was, there was a lady at the side of the stage doing face paintings on children. So we were working and these children were queuing up to have the face painted. So it was a bit, it was a bit off-putting sort of thing, you know what I mean? And then you'd see a guy coming down the centre of the room with a massive sort of load of balloons on strings, selling balloons. So it was a bit it was a bit off-putting, but yeah. But once again, you see, them sort of things, now you look back, were a learning curve. You had to keep going and you had to know how to handle it. So in a lot of ways, it was... I suppose in a lot of ways it were good.
Just there, did you get any strippers?
We only ever did one stag night, as they used to call them in them days, where... there was a mixed bag of strippers and comics. And Bob and I went into this club and the compere came in and he said, right, boys, he said, you're going to have to go tonight. You know, it's one of them nights. It's men only and it's this and it's that. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you're going to have to swear and you're going to have to, you know. And we said, blimey, don't know about that. We went on and I said, well, where does all the staff go? The girls, when the comics are on and they're swearing and stuff. He said, what happens is I go on and I said, right, ladies, it's now time to leave the room. And the comedian comes on and it's men only, so he can do what he wants to do. Well, Bob and I had never swore, in our act and, we were petrified, to be honest. But the strangest thing of all was there'd been a couple of comics on, and when Bob and I went on and we didn't swear, we got a standing ovation. So it worked out for us, you know.
The most striking thing about your early career is that you and Bobby auditioned for the heavyweight opportunity knocks.
Oh.
Nowadays, reality television is a firm staple of entertainment. Of the entertainment landscape, but what was the stigma around talent shows throughout the industry in that period?
Well, there was only one place to go to see whether you could get onto television, and that was Opportunity Knocks. When Bob and I went to Opportunity Knocks, we walked into this room and there must have been 500 or so people all waiting to be auditioned. It was crazy. And there was a guy on stage playing the piano and Bob said, "Wow, God, he'll never get past the audition. He's bad. He's really playing bad." And, that person was Les Dawson. So, it was a strange thing. We went on, we sang in them days and we passed the audition. And 2 years later, when we actually were invited to go back on, because there were that many people auditioning all the time that it was like queuing up. And, we went down on stage and Mr. Green, as you used to have to call him, came and said, excuse me, boys, he said, but I'm sure that when you came here, you were singing. I said, that's right, we were, Mr. Green. I said, but the problem is, we found out if you do a bit of comedy, you get a bit more money. So we started to do comedy. And he looked right at us and he said, be it on your own heads. And needless to say, we came last. Yeah.
More feet.
What did you think of him? Josh asked.
What, Huey Green?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was okay, but he was the star of the show, without a shadow of a doubt. He was the star of the old proceedings. Yeah.
As a comedy historian, I'm fascinated by the period which culminated in the final years of TV variety. And personally, I would pinpoint the end of this era just as Cannon and Ball began their TV dominance. In what ways were you conscious about preserving aspects of variety and vaudeville within your shows? And in what ways did Cannon and Ball stay true to the art of variety whilst offering something unique?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose when Bob and I were in America, we were working out there, and we watched TV, and suddenly this guy came on the television with jeans on and a T-shirt and started doing comedy. And me and Bob said, what the heck's this? What's look at him, he's in jeans, he looks terrible, and all this business. And little did we realise that this was the new age of comedy coming through. Mm-hmm. And we watched for quite a few weeks, and all these lads and lasses started to come on, and they were just very ordinary dressed, you know, ripped jeans, the knees showing through the jeans and stuff. And we couldn't understand it. And Bob and I both sat there one night and said, you know what? This will be in England in another 10 years from now. And it was. And it was the new alternative comedy that hit the television screens. And don't get me wrong, there has to be movement in show business like any business. If you're going to make a change, that's fantastic. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't make a change, as long as it's for the better and not for the worse. In mine and Bob's eyes, the alternative comedy wasn't as funny as variety. And so we wanted to try to keep variety alive on television, but eventually it just overtook us. We couldn't stop it.
You began your live comedy career on the Northern Men's Working Circuit, which for a time was a popular route into comedy, making stars of people like Bernard Manning. In your opinion, how important was the phenomenon of working men's clubs on the story of light entertainment?
The working men's clubs were tough. Quite right. There were lads in them days that worked down the pit, coal miners, worst job in the world. And when they went to their local club, because they used to call it their club, they wanted entertaining, without a shadow of a doubt. And if you weren't up to it, you would get paid off. And Bob and I got paid off, oh, I don't know, maybe three times in working men's clubs. But the Dial House in Sheffield, and we were singing a song. We were singing, what were we doing? Oh, yeah. Every night I'm sitting here by my window. And as we were singing the song, we were walking forward and walking back. As we walked back, these curtains started to come in. And so as the curtains started to come in, we went forward.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the curtains went back, we walked back. And that was the old process through the song. So when we'd done, we're walking off in the wings, and Bob said to the guy, he said, I think there's something wrong with your curtains, mate. He said, and he shouted at us, he said, there's nothing wrong with the curtains, which we've been trying to get you off for the past 20 minutes, you're rubbish. And that's one of the places where we got paid off. We got, I'll tell you exactly what we got. We got £3. £3 between us. Yeah.
Nick, you
did you do that club again?
No, we never went. We never did it again. No, no, we never did. I think if it had been offered to us, we wouldn't have done it. I think it had too many bad memories for us.
But this led to you being regulars on the ITV variety show, The Wheel Tappers and Shunters Club. In today's inclusive-minded society, performers like Bernard Manning are seen as products of their era and rightfully no longer have a place. Yet you and Bobby had a universal brand of humour which never discriminated against anyone or anything. Therefore, how did it feel to be associated with this era of comedy?
I don't know really. I mean, Bernard was a lovely man. He used to introduce us at his club in Manchester when we did it. And he used to introduce us, he used to say, "Ladies and gentlemen, the only double act were two straight men." And I mean, it got a roar from the audience. But in them days, we were still learning our trade, Bob. We were still getting together, you know, because we sang for the first few years of our, because it was strange. I always knew somehow we would turn to comedy because Bob was a naturally funny man. He was what I call the modern day Charlie Chaplin. Even now when I think back, I think, how the heck did we get into comedy? We were singing. We never even did anything so anywhere near remote comedy. And suddenly, bang, we're on TV and we've got our own show. And it's a comedy show. You go, wow, how the heck did that happen? And I can't honestly, with hand on heart, I can't remember how we got into comedy. I mean, for instance, the Rock on Tommy that Bob used to do at me, I was on stage because I used to go on a few minutes before Bob. I was singing this song and he came on and he went, "Whoa, Rock on Tommy," with his braces and did all that. And I thought, where the hell's that come from? He's never done that before. So when it was show was over, I said, "What made you say Rock on Tommy?" He said, David Essex, he recorded a song called Rock On. He said, and on the way down to the theatre, he said, I heard the song. I thought, it was just in my memory, he said. So I thought, I'll do that when I go on stage. Mm-hmm. And the rest is history, because then every time anybody saw me, it was, "Hey, Rock On, Tommy." It drove me mental, drove me crackers.
But it was a result of these shows which put you on the radar of TV execs. And in 1979, you secured your own self-titled ITV variety show, which ran for almost a decade. In the era which coincided with the rise of alternative comedy, how important was it to have a show which quintessentially mainstream comedy variety show?
Oh, I mean, I can't put it in... Excuse me. I can't really put it into words, because a few years before that, we went to the Glasgow Empire and there was a lad singing there. He never came to England. He was a great singer. And Bob and I were supporting him on the bill. We came off, we did our spot, and there was a guy stood in the wings. And as we passed him, he said, "Well done, boys." And that was it. So thank you. And that was the end to it. When we went to LWT, to sign our first TV contract, we walked in and we're in the office, and there was a corridor to the left of us, and as we're signing the contract, we look down and this guy's coming walking up, and me and Bob looked at one another and said, "He's familiar. What was he? Where do we know him from?" And it was the guy that was stood in the wings at the Glasgow Empire. And he came in, closed the door, he said, "Hello, boys," he said, "David Bell, head of Light Entertainment," and shook our hand. So from all them years back, suddenly this man came into our lives and he'd only ever said to us, "Well done, boys." So you look at it and you think, was it meant to be? Was it all going that way anyway? Was it all out of our control? Because it just happened.
Josh said he thought it was going to be a... Josh said he thought it was, you were going to say it was Des O'Connor.
Oh, with Des, yeah. Yeah, Des was a lovely man, yeah. He was a joy to work with. I suppose, really, he just let you do your thing, Des, no matter what happened. He worked with Eric and Ernie, and they used to take the mickey out of him, something terrible. And his face was wonderful. It was like he knew that they were only kidding. You know, they were only messing about with him. But Des was a great lad. He was fabulous. He was a fabulous actor, fabulous act, funny lad. Deserved everything he got in TV terms.
David Bell remains a legend of commercial light entertainment, comparable only to BBC's Bill Cotton. Mm. How pivotal was he to your Saturday night success?
Well, I suppose there were a lot of, you know, we never dreamed of people like, people coming over from America working on our show. I mean, you know, Little Richard. I mean, Bob loved rock and roll. I loved Frankie Lane came over. I mean, you just couldn't. When I think back now, while I'm talking to you, I'm thinking back and I think, how the heck did we achieve all that? How did that happen? We were so lucky that all that came to us. I can't put it into words because I have a backcloth that when I go out and I hang it down the back of the stage. And when we did the evening with in Blackpool for Bobby, we had this cloth up there and I'd never seen it before. And the stuff that was on it was incredible. I'm looking at this cloth thinking, how the hell have we done all that? It was incredible. And when the show was over, I shouldn't have said it, but I did. When the show was over, I said, "Right, that back cloth's mine." And the stage hand said, "Tom, you've got it, pal." And he dropped the sheet, wrapped it up and put it in the boot of my car. And I've still got it. It's incredible. When you look at it, you think, yeah, give over. We couldn't have done all that. We couldn't have done that in 50 years. Never mind the time that we'd done, but we had. It was incredible. Incredible.
Where is it now?
Just said, where is it now?
It's here, in my garage. It's in my garage. It's protected.
Josh said you should make it into a duvet.
I'd have to have a big bed for that.
Morecambe and Wise had Bring Me Sunshine. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore had Goodnight. But you and Bobby had Together We're Okay.
Yeah.
How important was this song in giving you a hook on which to leave your lasting impression on your audience? And
Well, when we went into the TV studio, we had to listen to three songs that were written by Nigel Hess. And the one that stood out by miles was Together We'll Be Okay. And that song, now, when I go and do the tribute stuff that Bob and I did, I open with that song every time. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't go on stage without doing that song. And it was, I never realised, I don't think Bob and I never realised that Together We'll Be Okay meant that, yes, we will be together and we will be okay. It was just a song. The truth and the home, the old truth of that song was that when we were together, we were great. And so that song will ever, ever and never leave my heart. It will always be there.
So how did this technique hark back to the golden years of theatrical variety, where acts had to have a certain versatility to their act?
I don't know, really. The song Together We'll Be Okay, Laugh Me a Laugh, Grin Me a Grin, it's all happy. It's all, I mean, I did it last year in pantomime, and the girl dancers did the part that Bob used to do. Rock on, Tommy, dance to a tune that this guitar plays. And when they did it, they all did it as though they had guitars in their hand, and they were all kicking their legs. And they were, oh, it was just magnificent. I mean, and after I'd done it for the first time to an audience, and I'd done it on my own, the audience realized what that song meant, because they stood up and gave me a standing ovation. So that song is mega in my mind, and I will never, ever stop singing it.
Obviously, during the 60s and 70s, there was a culture among TV producers of adapting popular TV formats into feature-length films. And in 1982, you and Bobby led an all-star cast in The Boys in Blue. How do you think this cemented your status as bona fide national treasures?
Well, I've got an original poster of that with all the stars' names on, and it was about, I think, maybe 3 months ago, the film was 40 year old, and Eric Sykes, who played in it with us, would, if he'd have been alive on that day, Eric would have been 100 years old, bless him. And that movie, there should have been another one after it, and whatever happened, I don't know, but it never got done. But that Boys in Blue, the first movie that Bob and I ever did, and the only one we've ever done, frightened us to death. So what we did was we sat and read the script like a book from the beginning right through to the end. So when we get onto the set, the director said, are you ready, boys, then? And we both said, yes, we're ready, okay. All right. He said, it's page 45, scene 7. And we went, eh? Because we'd learned it from the front. So we thought that the film was going to be filmed from the front, not from the middle, and then back to the front, and then back to the end, and all that messing about with it. So, of course, Bob and I had to learn that piece again, because we couldn't remember it, because we'd done it from the book, from the beginning. So everybody was howling, laughing at us. But once again, a learning curve, which obviously we haven't needed, because we didn't do another movie. But the learning curve from that was, all you've got to do is wait, or ring up the director and just say, what is the scene for tomorrow? And then you learn it. But oh, what a panic stations that were for us. Panic.
Oh, yeah. Every time I love to
But Josh said he loved Eric, and he said he would love to have interviewed him, and what was he like?
Yeah, he's a lovely man, Eric. he was, I'll tell you a true story. We were filming, there were me, Bob and Eric in this area that was like a main road, and at the top of the sort of street area, there was a double-decker bus that Eric had to run to catch it, you see. So we're all down there and we're talking away, and all of a sudden, the director said, action. And Eric never moved.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, Eric, the director just said action. He said, oh, sorry, lads. He said, but I've got these hearing aids. He said, they're new. He said, and they're in the ends of my glasses. He said, sometimes if I move my head too quick, it knocks the hearing thing. So I said, oh, all right. So Bob said, look, Eric, I'll tell you what I'll do. When the director says action, right, what I'll do is I'll say, I'll bang my foot like that on the floor, right? So the director never said action, but Bob banged his foot on the floor. And Eric shot off up for this double-decker bus with the director chasing him, saying, Eric, what are you doing? I didn't say action. Because he couldn't hear what he was saying. It was so funny. So funny.
Josh said he remembers a funny story that Jimmy Tarbuck told him about Eric.
The funny story that Jimmy.
Josh said at his 80th birthday, he stood and looked at himself and said, his legs are 80 years old. How have you worked for this long? Looked at his arms and said the same thing. You know, how have you carried us for this long? And it looked at his penis and said, if you were still alive, you'd be 80 years old as well.
Oh dear.
In 2001, you and Bobby joined a host of comedy legends for the cult BBC Choice sketch show Revolver. In your opinion, how did this show remind the audience, the television audience, of the pure magic of your generation? And why do you think it's not as fondly remembered as similar programmes of this era?
I don't know, really, to be honest. It's in fact, there are times when now me and Bob, when he was alive, bless him, we used to sit and we used to think, I don't get it. What's so funny about that? It's comedy now is not what Bob and I knew. and what we grew up with, you know, because even, I suppose, even as a child for me, and the amazing thing is that ending up in a double act, as a kid, double acts were my favourite. You know, Lollo Nardi, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, Martin and Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis, all these, you know, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, I used to go and see them. I used to pay, like, I think it was tuppence in them days to go and sit on a bloody old box and in the theatre. And the theatre was called the Savoy Hotel, which was literally 200 yards from where I lived. So, yeah, so like I said, when I look back, I go, wow, I can't believe I ended up in a double act. Because I just used to love double acts as a kid. And comedy now has no bearing on variety whatsoever. It's got no, don't get me wrong, some of the stuff is great. I like Jack Whitehall, I can't think of his name now, the lad from Bolton, Peter Kay, I love Peter. Them sort of lads still got that old, you can feel it sometimes coming from them. It's like the old style, the old fashioned. And when I say old fashioned, I don't mean it in a bad way. And I'm not calling the comedy of today, because there's lots of young people love it, and that's their choice. But it's not. It wouldn't be this, mine and Bob's bag. Wouldn't be it.
Yeah, Josh said there wouldn't be many people at the top of the bill at the London Palladium.
Top of the bill at the London Palladium was a very, very special occasion. It was frightening. You knew Her Majesty was there, and the Duke of Edinburgh, God bless them both. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience, certainly after the show, because in them days, the curtain would come across the stage, and then the royal family would come along saying hello to all the cast. And Bob and I were nervous wrecks, waiting for the Queen to come and say hello to us. You know, just to speak to us was frightening. You know, and she came and she said, "Well done, boys. Very, very funny." She said, "You're obviously from the north," and we both sort of had a giggle and we said, "Yes, ma'am." And she walked on. And I have to tell you, that experience will live in my mind forever, forever.
In 2020, Britain lost a comedy legend. What are your defining memories of Bobby Ball? And was there a point in the grieving process which made you consider retirement?
I don't know. The funny thing about Bob passing was that when he went into the night before, we were working at the Viva Club in Blackpool, and I knew he wasn't very well that particular night. He wasn't Bobby that I knew. I couldn't put my finger on it at all, but I know he wasn't in the best shape. And the following couple of days passed, and then he went into hospital. And typical Bob, he FaceTimed me, and there were 5-6 nurses all round his bed. And he said, "Tommy, all these nurses want to wave to you, mate." I said, "Bob, I thought you were poorly. He said, why? I said, I'm not the best, mate. He said, but I said, he said, I think these, they'll get me better. I said, well, let's hope so, pal. And then from then on, he just went downhill. It was so sad. I got a phone call from his son saying, I've got some bad news for you, Tom. We don't think my dad's going to make it. And I went, oh my God. I couldn't go and see him. Like I said, he passed away. And I was just in a different place. I didn't know where I were. I didn't know what to do. I went to the, like I said, I went to the church and me and my wife, and that was the first time I cried was in church. And even still now, I can think about something that we did together, and it will always bring a tear to my eye. But now, in a lot of ways, it's a happy tear, because I know he's happy. I know he's doing okay up there. He's with all his greats. He's with all the great people, all the funny men. He's having a whale of a time. And I hope he carries on. Bless him.
What do you think he was a man of your
now? I think Josh said, what would he make of your show now?
I think he would look down, and I know for a fact he's saying, carry on doing what you're doing, pal. Don't give in. And I just think he would, say, that is fantastic what you're doing, mate, because you are keeping, the memories of Tommy and Bobby to, well, sometimes an audience don't even know what Bob and I went through to get to the top of the tree, if you like. So it's all interesting. It's all the songs that we used to do and sing together. And I know he's saying, keep it going, pal.
What's next for Tommy Cannon? I ask this question to all my subjects, but it seems extra significant for you because of the incredible journey that you've been on since Bobby's passing. What's been the most surprising thing about your solo work?
I think the most surprising thing is that people want to see it, want to see me and want to hear what I have to say. It's been really, really heartwarming to see people come in to see what I want to tell them about me and Bob, how we worked, how we started, how we did it all, how we went 15 years before we got on TV. They are so shocked because some of the people think we were always on television and didn't do anything else. So, like I say, being in show business, I mean, all right, today's not the same. If you go on a show, maybe, and you win it, whatever type of show it is, the following day, you're a star. There's no, I don't know. Don't get me wrong. I don't know how many working men's clubs are still going these days, but there were a ladder in our day, and the ladder was pubs, working men's clubs, nightclubs, theatre, and television, if you were really lucky. So that was the ladder. I don't think there's a ladder there anymore.
Looking back at your career, what's been your proudest achievement?
Some of the moments that some of the moments that happened that weren't supposed to happen make me laugh. But I think the proudest thing of all for me was for Bob to pick me as his partner. And in them days, I used to think, what the heck are you doing coming to me and asking me to be your partner? Because I had no idea about show business whatsoever. And for the first three times that he asked me, I refused, point blank. I said, no, As he said, be a double act. I said, I want to be a double act. What's a double act? He said, well, we can sing. I said, I can't sing. And it went on and on and on for months till eventually I said, right, let's give it a go. And whatever he saw in me, he must have seen something, which I didn't know I had. And the rest is history.
So how do you want to be remembered?
Oh, just a lucky lad. Had a great career with Bob. I want to just be remembered as hopefully being an ordinary lad who got lucky and made it to the top of the tree.
Thank you very much to our wonderful guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title episode. If you like this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else you like? We're now on Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, Apple Music and Amazon Music. Everywhere, quite frankly. Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews, and please do give this podcast a little share. Not in a shoop-shoop song kind of way, you understand, although that's probably quite welcome. Thanks again. Hopefully see you next time. From all of us here, goodbye.